Missouri changed the way municipal courts worked after the Ferguson uprising with a lot of justification. Courts in that eastern Missouri town and others in the area treated citizens like ATM machines, convicting them of multiple traffic offenses and forcing them to pay up hundreds of dollars in fines, oftentimes levied against citizens who were poor. It was a disgrace. The General Assembly swooped in with a series of reforms that, while well-intentioned, have now been criticized as going too far. Judges now complain that municipal courts around the state have effectively been defanged, many of those facing fines for driving without a license or driving without insurance no longer pay their fines because they know the new rules won't result in them going to jail or even facing higher fines. In fact, judges say they can't do much of anything. The Star's editorial board, of which I'm a member, wrote about this in Sunday's paper. With us now, Gary Helm is the presiding judge in the Jackson County Municipal Court and the municipal court judge in Independence. Judge Helm, nice to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you very much.
Marty Kerr is here. He's a defense lawyer who also works in Independence. Marty, good morning.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Judge Helm, to what extent have you been defanged, if you will, by the new reforms that are out there?
Well, there's not a whole lot we can do when a defendant doesn't show up in court. We cannot suspend their driver's license. We can't give them warrant fees or late fees. And then we have to send them a summons to remind them to show up in court again. If they don't show up, there's just no ramifications, no extra penalties for not showing up. And any ticket that's 4 points or less, you can't put them in jail for. And these defendants are learning that, and they just don't show up.
So as a result, when I visited your court the other day on a recent Friday, you had some 360 cases on your docket, and there were precisely 7 defendants sitting out in your courtroom for the 10 o'clock start time.
Yes, that's because there's no incentive for them to show up in court, and they know that.
Marty Kerr, you've been practicing in Independence for more than a few years. What are you seeing out there?
Yes, Steve, as a defense attorney, some might think that this is good, that we have some more leniency in the law, some more flexibility, but it's not. In my opinion, what the legislature has done in their attempt to effect a cure for what may have been some problems in St. Louis area and Ferguson, they basically have got a cure that's about ready to kill the patient being the municipal court system. That's not good from anybody's perspective, even the defense attorney. We want a court system that is responsive to people's rights, to get a fair play when you go to court. But when you have clients that so many of them anymore know that they don't have to go to court, there's no consequences for not going to court, it doesn't help any of us. And that's what I'm seeing with these new laws that have been passed.
Judge Helm, why should the average Missourian out there who maybe doesn't have any business before a municipal court anywhere in the state, why should they care about this?
Well, it's a matter of public safety. These people are driving without insurance. They have expired tags. They're not paying their property taxes. It's a matter of public safety. And it's not about the revenue, because traffic tickets are a small part of municipal court. There's domestic violence, there's drug cases, there's housing code cases or animal cases. It's not about getting revenue, but it's about public safety, and it costs money to run a police department and provide police protection for the citizens.
And what's happening out there, Marty Kerr, is that as a result of the new law, it shrunk the amount of the maximum fines that could be levied, and also put in place some new requirements for how municipal courts have to be operated. That added cost here. We're seeing what? The closure of lots of municipal courts around western Missouri here, as well as police departments, the smaller ones that go with them.
Yes, absolutely. Again, that sounds to have merit, particularly for poor people, when you're saying we're going to stop excessive fines that abuse people. That's fine. But you look at the law specifically, it's limited the fine in some of these cases to $225. Okay.
That's the maximum
That's
fine
the
now.
Maximum. Now, that may sound good, but you have to understand that when we had fines before that were, say, a maximum of 500 or even 1,000, that didn't mean that the prosecutor in every case extracted that amount, or the judge.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have courts, prosecutors, and defense attorneys to negotiate. What it's done in some respect is, by reducing that fine down to 225, you've taken away the ability of the prosecutor and the defense attorney to perhaps take a number of tickets and get rid of some, save the client, the defendant, some points, keep him driving, keeping him on the road with insurance. But now you just have a limit of 225, where before you wanted a little more of an expansive, where you could work some things out and pay a little more money,
right,
and get a better result. So the irony is the lower fine sounds good, but in essence, many times it hurts the defendant.
You would think, Judge, that with a lower fine, that might encourage more defendants to come to court to take care of the matter and get it off the books.
Well, you would think that, but when there's no penalty for not showing up, there's no incentive to show up. The amount of fines doesn't really bother them. If we can't suspend their driver's license and can't put them in jail, they just don't show up.
Right. You know, there's some concern here that, folks don't show up. They get arrested sometimes, and because they can't be jailed, they're stopped on the street, but then they're let go by the officer, right?
Well, if it's a minor traffic ticket, 4 points or less, like no insurance, yes. But if it's a more serious, like a DWI, they didn't show up for court or driving while suspended, they're taken to jail and post bond as usual, what we used to do on all other traffic tickets. But if they're just charged with speeding, expired tags, no insurance, driving without a license, the police just advise them, well, there's a warrant out for you because you missed court, and then just let them go because those are non-jailable offenses. And so they just keep on driving.
There was one case involving a man named Larry Bradley of Independence that the Star cited, who had been arrested 6 times for failing to pay a years-old fine for driving with no insurance, never put in jail, and he once wrote a bad check to cover the $187 fine. You said we lost money as a result of that deal. Another defendant who didn't show up that Friday was Shawanda Brown, who had been arrested 4 times for a $450 ticket from 2015 for driving with no insurance and driving with a suspended license. She still hasn't paid. So she's been arrested, but again, she can't be held.
Well, on driving on suspended, they would take her to jail on a warrant for driving on suspended. But since it's for unpaid fines, they have to immediately give them another show cause date. So they're immediately released, given another show cause date. And if I remember correctly, she's missed court like 3 times on that, because you can't put them in jail without a hearing on their financial situation. So before you could really put them in jail, you have to have a hearing. So we give them a new hearing date immediately. They're immediately released, and then they don't show up again. So it's just a revolving door, a vicious cycle.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about changes in Missouri's municipal courts. Critics say the changes have resulted in lax regulations, people not going to jail, and as a result, not paying their fines. Critics say this was important and needed to be done because so many poorer citizens were racking up multiple fines they couldn't pay, and with disastrous results in their own lives. I want to read a statement from the state treasurer, Eric Schmidt, who was a state senator who was the principal sponsor of this set of new laws that went into effect in 2015. He writes, "I was proud to champion the municipal court reform measures passed by Missouri's legislature with broad bipartisan support in 2015. These changes and those that followed in 2016 were essential to repairing the breakdown of trust that had emerged across our state between local governments and municipal courts and the people they were supposed to serve." He goes on to say, "The problems weren't just in eastern Missouri, Judge. There were also problems in western Missouri towns like Randolph, Farrellview, and Sugar Creek, where poor folks were facing multiple fines, multiple citations, and facing jail time over and over again because of these tickets." What about that?
Well, it's very rare that we ever put people in jail for unpaid fines because we work with them. But getting multiple tickets, you have to understand that if they're pulled over for expired plates, and then a police officer finds out they're driving without insurance and driving while suspended, they give them multiple tickets. Mm-hmm. You know, my motto is, if you don't want to pay the fine, don't do the crime. Drive legally. It's a privilege. It's not a right.
Yeah, I was wondering, Marty, is the problem that started all this over in Ferguson, was that evident in some western Missouri towns too, like Randolph and Sugar Creek?
I don't think so, Stephen. I've practiced in those courts for many years. Of the 48 years that I've practiced law, part of that as a prosecutor for the county of Jackson, I've prosecuted in several jurisdictions. No. none of us can say that there aren't certain incidences where there's been some unjust things done by courts. Obviously, that can happen.
Right.
But no, I've not seen that in this part of the state where courts and or the police have been out just to stop hordes of people so they can get them to court and pay large fines. I have not seen that. I'm familiar with Mr. Smith's comments in these matters, and I question the soundness of what he says. This is a man who sponsored this bill and appears to me to be very wedded to it. And he needs to come around to these courts and see what's going on. I mean, like James Madison said, if people were angels, we wouldn't need government. And if people were angels, we wouldn't need courts. And as a defense attorney, I am extremely sensitive, as I know Judge Helm is, to the rights of people. But you have to have a system that has the capability to enforce the law. And that is simply, there's been a breakdown of that with this new system.
I want to read just a little bit more from a statement that we received this morning from Treasurer Eric Schmidt. He also writes, yet some municipal bureaucrats continue to find excuses to justify attempts to reverse the progress we've made as a state, progress that has been held up as a national model for success. The truth is, judges still have the power to issue orders for defendants to appear at court. Additionally, no data has ever been presented to support the idea that failure to appear cases have increased as a result of the passage of municipal court reform. Judge, respond to that.
Well, apparently he hasn't been to municipal courts. You know, he should ask all police chiefs across Missouri what they think of this law. The police departments do not like this law. They think there's a lack of enforcement, that defendants are getting off way too easy. I think he's totally misguided, and he needs to talk to police chiefs and mayors across the state of Missouri, as well as maybe show up in municipal court someday.
Judge Helm, let's break this down just a little further. If you would, give us a list of maybe three or four things that the General Assembly changed that have changed the game for you in a way that you don't appreciate.
Well, the main thing is we cannot suspend driver's license for failure to appear now. They've increased the workload because we have to send failure to appear summonses if they miss court the first time beforehand. If you got a ticket, didn't show up for court, it went immediate warrant. Now we got to send them a summons, so it greatly increased the workload on the court clerks. And then the reduction of the fine. Now that $225, that includes court costs too. And so it cuts the revenue so much, it's hurting the police departments and hurting the cities. That's why so many of these courts on this side of the state, like Randolph is closed, and Mould, Hosby, Lake Tappawingo, numerous courts have closed, and they're becoming burdensome if they go to the Associate Circuit Court.
I was going to say, when they close, Marty Kerr, what happens? Why should anybody care there?
Well, yeah, that may sound like a good thing, and maybe Mr. Schmidt thinks that it'll go over to the county courthouse to some associate circuit judge. It's already has huge dockets, but it's not. What it means is that city or community no longer is going to have a police department. So it isn't just people out writing tickets, but burglaries, domestic violence, other issues. They're not going to have the sufficient police service that they need, and that impacts us all.
So the lack of revenue even results in the police department in those little towns closing down, meaning they then have to rely on the Jackson County Sheriff, for instance, or the county sheriff in that area to take care of problems.
Certainly, and there's going to be a cost for that. The sheriff's going to need to add deputies. The courts at the county court level are going to need to add staff, or if they can, if the budgets allow.
Not to mention response times. In a little community can increase dramatically if you're relying on a sheriff's deputy to drive across the county versus a police officer right in your little town.
Absolutely. As Judge Helm was saying, our main complaint with this is the impact on public safety.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. It didn't used to be this way, right, Judge? On a Friday morning in court, there'd be more than seven defendants sitting there.
Oh, yeah. We used to have at least 75% of the defendants used to show up. And then after these changes in the law, 2015, 2016, fewer and fewer people show up. So we're lucky to get a third of the people in court now.
Okay. Let's go to a phone call here. Jennifer from Liberty. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I've just been listening, and I guess I have a few points I'd like to make. You know, I listened to I believe it was the judge talking about how it's a privilege to drive, and if people don't want to do the time, they shouldn't do the crime or whatever. And I just kind of want to point out that we do live in an area that has really poor public transportation. And I think, unfortunately, a side effect of that is people feel like they have to have a car whether they can really afford it or not. So that would be one thing. I also think that several times they've mentioned that this is affecting the funding for police departments.
Right.
And I would argue that's unfair to place a funding burden on communities that can least afford it. And I think perhaps if as a community we decide that we want to fund those more adequately, then we need to raise taxes to do so. And I guess
that city police department, your point, Jennifer, they shouldn't be funded by ticket revenue. Is that where you're going there?
Well, yeah. And I mean, by communities that are least able to pay it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're talking about people that are driving on suspended license or without insurance, that's because they don't have the money.
Right.
I mean, let's be honest.
Let me get some response from our guests here to what Jennifer's saying, because her point is central to what brought these reforms about in the first place, that municipal courts and cities, in fact, were being funded by ticket revenue in towns like Ferguson. Does it make sense to you, Marty, that, you know, if you're going to fund a municipal court or a police department, it shouldn't be on the backs of fines? It should be funded separately through property taxes?
Well, yes, municipal courts and the police department are not funded solely by municipal court revenue. They're not. And to me, a fine is probably one of the most direct taxes we have and probably one of the most fairest we have, in that if we screw up, and I'm talking about me or my clients, and we have to pay something to extricate ourselves from that problem, then that is a fair means of doing it. But that revenue doesn't just go directly to the police department. It goes into the city budget as a whole, which funds many things.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion, I mean, I wish I could use that as a defense on cases where I have people who are driving without a license or speeding as well. They need a way to get to work. Well, like the judge said, driving is not a right. It is a privilege, and therefore you have some laws that deal with that accordingly. So,
okay. Jennifer, thank you for the phone call. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Judge, is there a compromise here? Can you see a path forward? The General Assembly took a look at it again this year and then ultimately backed away from altering some of these reforms. What's the path forward?
Well, we need to lobby our legislatures to make a change back, at least halfway back to what it was before. I mean, one of the best ways to get people to show up in court is to suspend their driver's license for their failure to appear, and then they want to get their driver's license back, they need to take care of their tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to sound callous, that young lady is concerned about fines on poor people, but if they don't have the money to buy insurance and drive legally, they shouldn't be driving.
Mm-hmm. Marty, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, being a defense attorney, I have there's a tug here to kind of side with the person who's having a rough time. I defend people all the time who have some pretty sad stories, and I try to represent them as best I can. But we have to have a system with some teeth in it. Like the judge was saying, I don't know if there's a halfway on this. I did not see the system as broken before, just to be honest. I plainly saw that legislation that came out of a situation down in Ferguson that was primarily a socioeconomic issue, and this was an attempt through municipal court to change something that wasn't broke that is now very broken.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to go back to the way it was. If policemen are stopping citizens because they're black or minorities, that's wrong. That has nothing to do with this legislation. If the city is picking on poor people to get them to court to get revenue out of them, that is wrong. That was not the system around here in the 40-some years that I've practiced. They have taken something and changed it, and it needs to go back to the way it was. It's pretty simple. People don't show up for court. There needs to be a warrant. We can deal with that. People can deal with that.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Tony from Independence. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm listening to the show today.
Yes.
I'm enjoying myself, but I'm going to be brief. the idea, and we got to start with ideas and concepts, because the concept that it is a privilege to drive makes no sense, and I've heard it all my life. If you buy a car, you have to pay taxes on it, you have to pay for the plates, and now you have to pay for insurance. The fact that that can be snatched away on one of the earlier callers, people need transportation in order to live, because you can't work without the transportation. So this idea and this concept of saying it's a privilege needs to be taken out of the discussion, because if I pay for the car, how do you get the right to tell me whether I can drive it or not if I'm doing the right things? So we need to go back and really look at this, because we're still working with very old concepts, and we're trying to make everything work around it.
Judge Gary Helm, respond to Tony, if you would.
Well, you got to have insurance and drive legally. I mean, that's to protect other people in case you have an accident. I mean,
that's understandable.
I mean, if you can't afford insurance, you shouldn't drive. I mean, how would you feel if an uninsured person ran into you and couldn't pay for the damage to your car or pay for your injuries?
Oh, it's happened before, and I do understand that. And I'm not, that's not my question, but the idea that it is a privilege. A woman earlier said that if you live in a small town and you don't have public transportation, your car is your lifeline for your family to be able to go work. So you don't have food, you don't have money for your children, utilities, all those things that you are supposed to take care of, it'll get snatched away all in one fell swoop.
So, Tony, what's the path forward here, Tony?
Well, my thoughts about this is, A, you can't look at it like this is a privilege. Because once you say that, then where do you go from there? A privilege? When you buy a bicycle, what is your privilege to now ride on the bicycle? You bought the bicycle. It's yours. Now, I understand the insurance is necessary because if you do have accidents, if you've got somebody who's driving and they're reckless driving, yes, that's all. These are all the safety measures we have. It's not going to be perfect. But if you come at people, if you have the idea that you snatch these things away, you cause more problems for the citizen than the problems you're trying to solve in the first place.
All right. Tony, I appreciate your phone call. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Jack from Lee Summit. Jack, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about Missouri's municipal courts. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for having me.
Go ahead, Jack.
Yes. I find myself in disagreement with the judge, mainly because he hasn't cited even examples or impressions of his generalization that this is a public safety issue. I grant that drunken driving is, but I've heard no evidence, and especially I've heard no evidence with a valid statistical study behind it, that this is indeed a public safety issue.
Let me let the judge respond to that, Jack. Go ahead.
Well, it is a public safety issue because we have to make sure everybody's driving insured and with cars that are not defective. We also need police officers to, patrol for crimes and protect the citizens. So I disagree with you that it is a public safety issue. And insurance is one of the most important things to have on a vehicle in case you hurt anybody.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls here. We had a full board of calls. I want to thank Judge Gary Helm, the presiding judge in Jackson County Municipal Court, and Marty Kerr, a defense lawyer who works over in Independence. Thank you for your views. We'll see where this thing goes forward. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk books and good things to read this summer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. More than a year ago, voters passed a citywide sales tax intended to help revive Kansas City's urban core, but none of those funds have been spent yet. You can find out when and where the money will be used by listening to yesterday's conversation. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, if you know anything about the civil rights history of this city, you likely know the name of longtime Kansas City Call journalist Lucille Bluford. Join us for a look at her life and the legacy she Left Behind tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Oh, the dog days of summer are either here or are fast approaching. So today we're talking books with a pair of book lovers who also classify as book experts. Each of our experts has picked a newish fiction book to recommend, a newish nonfiction book, a favorite classic, and a book release are looking forward to later this year. So got that, four selections for the price of one. With us, Patience Randall is the creator of Ink and Fable. That's a storytelling brand that connects bookworms and creatives. Her website is patiencerandall.com, and it's worth checking out. Patience, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Whitney Terrell is back. He's a creative writing professor at UMKC. He's also the author of The Good Lieutenant, The Huntsman, and The King of Kings County, co-host of the fiction nonfiction podcast at Literary Hub, and a former embedded reporter in Iraq covering the war for The Washington Post magazine, Slate, and NPR. Whit, it's nice to have you back again.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go first with some fiction here, folks. And Patience, you picked the book Bird Box by Josh Mellerman.
Yes, it's an older book, but it's actually being made into a movie this year. So I thought it was worth revisiting. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, why is it one of your favorites?
Oh my goodness, the suspense, the thrill, everything, the writing style is just amazing.
Give us a quick plot line. What is this book about?
Sure. Something's out there, something terrifying that must not be seen. One glimpse of it, and a person is driven to deadly violence, and no one knows where it comes from. So it keeps you going throughout the whole thing until the very end.
Who's going to star in this movie, and when's this movie going to be out, and what should I read the book first, obviously, right?
You should definitely read the book first. It's starring Sandra Bullock.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's out next year. I'm not quite sure.
So it's like a major motion picture.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock's involved in it.
Yes,
so, okay.
Definitely.
That book, again, is Bird Box. The author is Josh Mellerman. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Whitney, let's move on to you here. You wanted to talk about a book, Dead Girls and Other Stories by Emily Geminder.
Geminder. Emily, the reason I brought this story up, this book up, is it came out in 2017 in the fall. It was well-reviewed in the Times and was on a bunch of lists and Bustle and other really good magazines. Emily got her MFA at UMKC, and a lot of these stories were taught in our, she workshopped in our classrooms over just across the street. So we're super proud. She was a Durwood scholar, so the Durwood Foundations, it's based on Stanley Durwood's estate, brought her here. Bus, I think it's a great book. I mean, it's just a really terrific, dazzling, unbelievably voiced collection of short stories that was published by Dezank Books, which is a Midwestern, smaller press, but they've been getting more and more attention. Places like Grey Wolf and Coffee House Press and small presses like Dezank are starting to get reviewed in the Times and get books out there, and I'm really, really proud of her, and I think the book is well worth the people's time.
Well, I've got to ask, was she one of your students?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember workshopping these stories.
She's good because you taught her,
right?
No,
no, no. That is not why. She came in very talented, and we were excited to have to recruit her, basically.
You brought us a short passage to read from Dead Girls and Other Stories.
Yeah, this is from a story called Your Village Has Been Bombed, and this is an amazing... This is... A lot of her stories are actually told from a young woman's point of view and their family stories, but this book, this one is somewhat different. It's told sort of from the point of view of, I don't know, maybe drone aircrafts, right? Or like an enemy aircraft. But she turned this story in to workshop, and it was in this form, ready to be published. Beautiful piece, and it's an amazing, haunting story. I'll read just the first. It's a series of letters. The first letter goes, "Dear citizens, your village has been bombed. The area demarcated in red on the map below displays a target zone of high enemy concentration. Your village, falling within this zone, is subject to strategic airstrikes of sublime and proportional magnitude, otherwise known as death from the sky." This leaflet, dropped from above, is neither an expression of regret nor a warning, but a stating of terms. The enemy hides among you.
Wow. that gets you pretty
quick. That's
pretty
good, huh?
That's called a good lead, I think, in the news biz, yeah. So you could tell that she had talent just as you worked with her?
My colleagues, Christy Hodgen and Michael Pridgett in prose, knew immediately, like, oh, this is a really special writer. I mean, we gave her the Durwood Scholarship coming in because that's for the best writers that we have who apply to the program.
Yeah.
You know, so we knew.
The author, again, Emily Geminder. Am I saying that right?
Geminder.
Geminder.
That's
I got
a hard
it wrong
name.
Twice.
There's no, yeah, yeah. That's all right.
Dead Girls. and
maybe
other
I'm saying
stories.
It wrong. We could. There's been argument.
Let's go with that. Let's just say you are, and I had all it right. Okay. Let's move on to the nonfiction category, and Patience Randall wants to talk about The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin.
It's just one of my favorite all-time classics and nonfiction pieces by James Baldwin, and I think it should be required reading in all schools.
Why is that?
Oh my goodness, it's so relevant, even though it was written when it was written, it's just so relevant to what we're going through today in America, and I just think it's very important.
Tell us about, what is the story about?
He actually writes a letter to his nephew and to America. And I think the way that he describes his feelings about race relations is just with so much love and understanding. And I think that's something that we could all learn from.
How quickly did this book grab you as you started off in it?
Oh, the first few pages. And it's so short, you can read it in a day. And I highly recommend it.
Well, not many books I can read in a day, but you're saying even I could get through
it
that
way.
Oh,
for sure. Yeah. Definitely.
What stuck with you with this book after you finished it?
We cannot be free until they are free. You must accept them and love them with love. They are trapped in a history that they do not understand. And I feel that is just... I can't even...
Who's he talking about there?
Oh, America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
James Baldwin, one of our great writers. How long has he been gone from us now?
Oh my goodness, I don't know.
It's been a few years.
It's been several years, right, for sure. Yeah.
There was recently a really great documentary made about
him. I Am Not Your Negro.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Which I meant to go see at the Tivoli and never did.
It's really good.
Yeah.
What other books does this one remind you of, Patience?
Who reminds me of? Oh.
Are there other books like this out there, or is this something unto itself?
There's got to be more books out there like this.
Wouldn't Ta-Nehisi Coates' book be sort of in the pattern of...
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, that book again, The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin and Patience Randall, guarantees that even you can read this book in a single day, right?
Yes.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with our book critics today, Patience Randall, Whitney Terrell, going through a series of fiction, nonfiction, classic recommendations for good summertime reading here. Whit, let's move on to Rendezvous with Oblivion by Thomas Frank.
Yeah, well...
One of our Kansas City
writers. Tom is a Kansas City guy. People probably will remember What's the Matter with Kansas, which I think came out in 2004. But this is a collection of essays that he's been writing sort of since the beginning of the Obama administration and up through the Trump election. And so if you want to see what Tom has been up to, and he's been up to some really interesting stuff, and he's focusing on inequality, really, in this collection. He has a great essay in there called The Architecture of Inequality that's about the history of the McMansion, what they mean, what it means, you know, to be building houses like that. And he says, look, of the essay collection, what we've learned during these years and what those houses, McMansions, show is that one class of Americans was essentially taking its leave of the rest of us.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
He's a Mission Hills kid.
Yeah, so he knows a little bit about McMansions anyway.
And he also wrote a book titled What's the Matter with Kansas a few years ago that captured a lot of
attention. And Listen Liberal is his most recent full-length book that came out before the Clinton election. And it's, you know, Tom is a lefty and a progressive, but it was critical of the Democrats in some of the messages that he reiterates in this Rendezvous with Oblivion are consistent there, that Democrats have gotten too far away from thinking about the poor and working class, that they are becoming meritocrats, and they care about, you know, getting great degrees in Yale and going to Harvard, but they aren't thinking about what has been their traditional base of voters.
Given his political leanings, do you think we need to take this book with a grain of salt?
What does that mean?
Well, I'm just asking.
I think he's right.
Okay.
And I think this interesting thing about Tom is that he has been willing to be critical of the Democratic
mm-hmm.
Party.
Mm-hmm.
And that has earned him no friends sometimes, right?
Right.
I mean, he doesn't follow party line. He is a contrarian and a very independent-minded thinker.
Yeah, I remember talking to him after What's the Matter with Kansas came out, and there was such an explosion of interest in him and that book, and he was struggling to find a follow-up, and I guess he's managed along the way.
Well, I mean, there have been a bunch of books in between there. He's been very productive, but, you know, What's the Matter with Kansas has sort of entered into the canon. I teach it, you know. So I just think this is a these are really smart, interesting essays, and people who care about politics today would want to read them.
Okay, that book again from Whitney Terrell, recommended by Whitney, Rendezvous with Oblivion, the author, our own Kansas City guy, Thomas Frank. Let's move on to some classic books that, you know, go back and seem to be good forever. Patience, you wanted to mention The Book of Disquiet.
Yes, by Fernando Pessoa. He's a Portuguese poet and writer from the early 1900s, and I have just worn this book out. It's falling apart. I need another edition of this.
How did you come across this book before you read a little bit from it?
I don't even remember. Maybe it was a recommendation from someone. I seriously can't remember. I just know I've been holding on to it ever since, and it's just one of my favorites.
Why is it one of your favorites? What is The Book of Disquiet about?
So it was actually almost like a diary of sorts. It was published after his passing in 1935. And it's just very beautifully written and lyrical, and it's gorgeous.
And it's about what?
Everything.
Everything.
I'll read a passage to you.
Read a passage, please.
About dreaming. Sometimes, right in the middle of my active life, when I'm evidently as clear about myself as anyone is, a strange feeling of doubt enters my imagination. I do not know if I exist. It seems possible to me that I might be someone else's dream. The idea occurs to me, with an almost carnal reality, that I might be a character in a novel, moving through the long waves of someone else's literary style, through the created truth of a great narrative. I've often noticed that certain characters in novels take on for us an importance that our acquaintances and friends who talk and listen to us in the real invisible world could never have. And this thought provokes the dream question. Is everything in the whole world just a series of interlocking dreams and novels like smaller boxes fitting inside of larger ones?
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Do you think less of me because I've not heard of this book and I've not heard of this author before?
No, I don't think less of you.
I totally don't know it either.
Oh.
I'm psyched to hear
better.
It.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's one of my all-time favorites. And,
but you don't know how you came across it.
I really don't remember. It was in college. I don't remember if I was reading about it or if someone told me I should read it. I just know it's just been one of my top recommendations ever since.
Do you know roughly when it was written?
Oh, early 1900s, I believe.
Oh, so we go back.
Yeah, we go way
it's
back.
It's definitely a classic.
But it wasn't published until after he passed away in the 1930s. So.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Again, that book, The Book of Disquiet.
Yes.
Okay. Whitney.
I got a twofer here because Jean Rhys, who's a novelist and short story writer from the middle part of the 20th century, wrote a great book called Wide Sargasso Sea, which is a retelling of Jane Eyre. And it also brings in sort of the backstory of colonialism and slavery that is sort of hidden in the English, you know, telling of that story. And so it's like the story of the, you know, Mr. Rochester has a wife who's crazy and lives in the attic in Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. This is her backstory. And in Wide Sargasso Sea, she grows up this woman Antoinette in who's renamed Bertha in Jane Eyre grows up in it's set in Jamaica and Dominica, which is the island that Jean Rhys grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
And so Carol Phillips, a contemporary writer, has just come out with a novel called A View of the Empire at Sunset, which is a retelling of Jean Rhys's life.
Oh, you're kidding.
And it was just reviewed in the New York Times. So we were actually talking to Pamela Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, on the podcast this week. It'll be out on Thursday, discussing reboots, books that have been remade or redo some other. And so there's this whole history from Carol Phillips' book back to Jean Rhys's book back to the Bronte novel. So
how did you come across The Wide Sargasso Sea?
I read it in high school. It was assigned. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a great book. In fact, I read it before I read Jane Eyre. I didn't really understand the connection. I just thought it was
a great book.
Terrific novel.
And it came out when, roughly?
66?
1966.
Like a year before I was born.
By Jean Rhys?
Yeah. I used to call her Jean Rhys, but I'm pretty sure that the actual French pronunciation is Jean Rhys. So.
And I would know.
That's what Pamela
like that.
Did on the podcast. And I was like, all right, I've been doing it wrong this whole time.
Yeah. Okay. How about an upcoming book that will be released in the months to come that's got you all ginned up and excited? Patience, you wanted to mention a book titled Cherry by Nico Walker.
Yeah, I actually just received a galley of this book in the mail last week, and I started reading it, and I...
Of course you received a galley because you're Patience Randall. You get these things sent to you in the mail, right?
Yeah, I could not put it down. It's for fans of Trainspotting and Full Metal Jacket, and it's a story about war and addiction. And the author, Nico, actually wrote the entire thing on a typewriter while he was in prison. And I think he's got a few more years to serve, but it's just, it's pretty raw and amazing.
And the plot would be just roughly what?
Oh my goodness, roughly what? It's, the way he writes is so, how do you call it? Very
episodic.
Very Chuck, Fight Club-ish type mm-hmm. kind of deal. So it just kind of just weaves and bobs throughout this story of his life.
Okay. And that's coming out in August,
yeah,
I think,
next
right?
year, yes.
That next year.
Oh, sorry. August next month.
Next month,
yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's good. We
yes.
can't wait any longer. Cherry by Nico Walker. Whitney, what do you want to recommend here?
So this is a graphic novel by the writer and illustrator Mira Jacob. It's called Good Talk, Conversations I'm Still Confused About. Mira's an Indian-American writer. She, you can see her cartoons up at Shondaland, which is Shonda Rhimes, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Website. Shonda Rhimes is the famed television producer who did, what is the one about the presidency?
Kerry Washington. I can't remember. I don't know.
Come on, the famous one. All right. My wife watches this and she's going to kill me.
Gilmore Girls.
No.
No?
No.
That was a guest by our producer. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, Shonda Rhimes, very famous Hollywood producer, has this website. Mira's stuff shows up there. But this graphic memoir is about conversations she had with her 9-year-old, 8-year-old son around the times of Ferguson and what it was like growing up being a young boy, a brown-skinned boy, as he calls himself at this particular time. His father's white. His mom is Indian-American. He's trying to figure out ideas about race at a very time when race is at the forefront of national discourse.
And that book is Good Talk, Conversations I'm Still Confused About. And of course, that would be a topic you'd be confused about.
Yeah, and she's on, again, the podcast, the Fiction Nonfiction podcast this week, so you can listen to her if you look us up.
What other books might you guys recommend if, as we sit here and think about summertime, maybe things that didn't quite make your list? What, you had a couple things you wanted to mention here.
Oh, I just had some books that I'm also a judge for the Young Lions Fiction Award, which is run by the New York Public Library. So mm-hmm. we had some finalists this year that I thought were really great. Vanita Blackburn. This is a book that's not that well known. It was published by the University of Nebraska Press, and it's called Black Jesus and Other Superheroes. It's the kind of book that never makes the finalists for one of these national awards, but it's a great collection of short stories, and it did make the finalists for the Young Lions Award this year. It didn't win, but I just wanted to point out to people this book. It's like rural African-American experience. It's really interesting. It's funny. It's a great voiced book.
Black Jesus and Other Superheroes by Vanita Blackburn.
That's correct.
Okay. You have another one here from What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky.
Yeah, Leslie Arima. That book won the New York Young Lions Award. She is a Nigerian writer, and this is a book set in Nigeria and in America. So that book has gotten a ton of press. You won't have any problems finding it. And the last book I wanted to mention is a guy named Bruce Holbert, who wrote a book called Whiskey that's set in Washington State. That's sort of like, if you like Cormac McCarthy,
yeah,
you would like Bruce Holbert's Whiskey.
And our producer points out that Shonda Rhimes was involved with Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
We have that reference right now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our critics for coming in and spending some time with us here. Patience Randall, creator of The Ink and Fable, a storytelling brand that connects bookworms and creatives. Whitney Terrell, creative writing professor over at UMKC, author of all kinds of good books, including The Good Lieutenant. Thank you both for coming in. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yesterday on the show, why some teens use fake social media accounts as they explore their sexuality. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske and follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, what happens when a farming operation gets the okay to go from housing 1,000 cows to nearly 7,000? For starters, it makes neighbors unhappy. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.